The morning, some lingering flurries. Then a sunny, breezy, and cold afternoon, a high reaching only 19. Perspective on that number, normal high is 30. The record high for this date was 52. That was set in 1909. Tonight, clear and bitterly cold, overnight low one above. And then Friday, we start a warm-up. Friday should be sunny and cold with a high of 20. Saturday, cloudy and 36. And then Sunday, seasonal and 30. Right now, 18 degrees Kenosha, 16 Racine, very windy. Wind northwest at 16, gusting to 23. Wind chill this morning is minus 10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm pleased and honored to be sitting opposite Dr. Art Sear now for the first time in 2025. Professor Sear has been a monthly visitor to the morning show for well more than 20 years and a mainstay to the program in so many respects. And Professor Sear always has intriguing insights on, especially on a lot of issues that sometimes get treated, shall we say, maybe rather carelessly by the mainstream media, and often has true insights that really help kind of reshape the way we maybe frame certain issues or concerns. And we have a number of real big stories and issues to explore over the next few minutes. So I just want to just add that Professor Sear has a wealth of experience as a fine columnist with columns that appear in newspapers all across the country. He's also author of the book After the Cold War. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be welcome back.
Glad to have you here.
Especially on your fine program. Best wishes for 2025 to you and our many listeners out there in Radio Land.
Very good. Very good. I thought one of the things we should maybe do is just take a few minutes right off the bat to talk about, first of all, these first days of President Trump's second term and all that has happened. It seems like a kind of a flurry of activity. And also talk about the waning days of the Biden administration, which saw, among other things, of course, what generated probably the biggest headlines in the last days of his administration some of the pardons that he issued, particularly to members of his own family. Maybe just for the sake of chronological flow, let's begin with outgoing former President Joe Biden. And I'm just curious if you have any particular reaction to those pardons which came at the end of his administration. And is that uncommon, or is that something that we often see as a U.S. president is about to leave office?
No, I believe presidents, at least in recent times, have taken the opportunity to pardon people when they're leaving office, as well as at other times. It's usually a pretty selective process, and Biden wasn't particularly selective, and he let some pretty serious criminals loose. I was quite surprised. He also, as you indicated, pardoned preemptively members of his family, which is a bad look, and reinforces an image that it's a gang of grifters, that these people led by Joe Biden have been taking advantage of the government. A fair or unfair perception, it's out there and has been since before his son Hunter was convicted of some fairly serious federal offenses. Mm. So it's a bad idea. It's bad for his legacy, which is already not the greatest in my biased opinion.
Right. What about the opening days of President Trump's second term in which he issued a series of executive actions, executive orders, I think a number of them even on Inauguration Day, I mean, hours, maybe minutes after being sworn in as president for his second term. I saw by one reckoning that 78 of former President Biden's policies were revoked with the signing of those executive actions. Again, is that something exceptional, or quite often do presidents take office and then hit the ground running in terms of issuing executive orders, or does this feel like or seem like something maybe a bit exceptional?
Well, they hit the ground running in terms of image. Trump specifically did not do much. Again, personal biases are unavoidable, and on your program, you welcome them, so thank you very much. But
In his first term?
Yeah, the first time around, he a saving grace, from my point of view, is he actually didn't do that much. He did do some decisive things, but clearly he wants to have much more impact of a practical, not just rhetorical, in PR sense, right away. But the sense of the need for action and urgency of action is something that in modern times has been characteristic of various presidents in different ways. Most famously, FDR in the first 100 days, when an enormous array of legislation as well as executive orders, mind you, executive orders have become much more commonplace in more recent years. But FDR is legendary for including a national bank holiday, which may well have averted a violent revolution in this country. And that gets at the fact that that was a terrible time economically, psychologically. We're not in that situation today, although if you just pay attention to the media, you might think we are. But Roosevelt put a lot of legislation through Congress right away. Now, at that time, the Republicans in the Senate could be fit into a dining room, and in the House could be fit into a small meeting hall after the elections of 1930 and reinforced by 32. But Democrats especially referred to that. John F. Kennedy, a very PR-conscious president immediately started sending legislation to Congress. One problem for that president was that most of it got jammed up right away. He did have very significant legislative accomplishments, which tend to be overlooked nowadays, but there was a lot of frustration in the Kennedy administration. Lyndon Johnson, who of course was inaugurated in tragic circumstances November 22nd, 1963, on Air Force One before it took off for Washington, he insisted that it be handled that way, and I think he was probably right. Perhaps the greatest legislative genius, at least of the 20th century, President Johnson, like his hero FDR, moved a tremendous amount of legislation through. McGeorge Bundy, Kennedy's national security advisor, who continued for a little over 2 years under LBJ, referred to the fact that it was one freight train a minute. Talking about it in retrospect, it was just astonishing what Johnson was able to get through. He and FDR and others knew that things do not get better. You have very limited time in Washington before the opposition starts really piling up, no matter who you are.
Right.
And that's something politicians are very mindful of. But it's a very good question, and I could go on at even greater length. Eisenhower, for understandable political reasons, emphasized a relaxed image, the famous golfer, the genial father figure. But as we know now, undeniably, he worked like hell all the time. And from day one, the Eisenhower administration was extremely active in developing bipartisan rapport with the leaders of Congress that looks better and better all the time. And all kinds of things went through. The so-called do-nothing president, including health, education, and welfare, expansion as well as confirmation of Social Security and a lot of things. So you got to look beneath the surface. But the short answer, which is the better answer sometimes with me, is no, it's not unprecedented. And Trump, trying to be fair to him, Trump has struck a more positive note in his inaugural address than was the case the first time around, and I do hope that continues.
Right. Among his executive actions, and of course, that's probably a distinction that's important to remind people about as well, that it's one thing to get legislation through.
Yes.
It's another thing to just sign a piece of paper, an executive order.
Well, legislation sticks.
Well, right.
You've actually got to get it repealed. It's not the stroke of a pen, which is relatively easy to do.
Right. So, but executive actions are one thing,
yeah.
and legislation that makes its way through Congress is another, and that's a different kind of accomplishment.
Important point. Thank
yeah.
you.
The executive actions, among other things, if I understand correctly, withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement and withdraw us from the World Health Organization. And I just wonder if you see significance there or are alarmed or relieved, or is there significance in when executive orders have that kind of impact?
They often are limited in terms of time. The president can impose tariffs, for instance, which he's been emphasizing throughout the campaign and certainly right up to today. But if the tariff is going to stay in place with any permanence, you've got to get Congress to repeal it. So when it comes to really important things, treaties involved in Congress at some point has to act. Climate change, it's been controversial from the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement has been controversial from the start. And the first time around, he took us out of that as well, along with the controversial Iran nuclear control deal between us and six other major powers plus Iran.
Right. Well,
so the short answer is no.
Right. Since your last time on the morning show, we lost former President Jimmy Carter, who passed away at the age of 100. No U.S. president has lived such a long life. No former president has had such a long post-presidency, as did President Carter. And your column about President Carter is really interesting in that it largely looks past that post-presidency that I think you rightly say the media has spent a lot of its time talking about and spoken very little about his actual presidency, and in particular the accomplishments of his presidency, which you think were actually quite significant. In fact, I think you lead your column by saying, in death as in life, former President Jimmy Carter can't seem to get a fair shake. So your column seeks to try to restore what you think are neglected appreciation of what he did as president. Explain to our listeners the nature of his most important accomplishments as president that I think you very rightly say are largely overshadowed by maybe missteps or unfortunate occurrences in his presidency.
Well, amid some not-so-successful personnel appointments at the top, he picked some exceptionally significant people, most notably probably Paul Volcker, who was nominated by President Carter, although he served primarily under President Reagan, as head of the Federal Reserve. And Volcker imposed the discipline necessary to bring inflation under control and therefore take some of the pressure off unemployment. Unemployment and inflation together, stagflation, which Keynesian, pseudo-Keynesian economists in the Kennedy administration had thought was impossible. They thought it was going to be a reverse relationship. They were wrong, as we often are, especially academics, in policy positions. Unemployment and inflation together were approaching 20%, which is almost unbelievable. And it was a desperate situation resulting from the oil shocks of 73 and then 79 by the oil-producing countries led by the Arab states, irresponsible policies by the Johnson and Nixon administration. Those two presidents were a very unfortunate and unhealthy combination in retrospect, in my opinion. Volcker was crucial. Likewise, Tom Clawson, Alden W. Clawson, head of Bank of America twice, and in between Robert McNamara's successor as head of the World Bank, a much less visible figure than Volcker. But McNamara, who was a real showboater, to his credit, did greatly expand the lending of the World Bank to the poorest countries in the world. In so doing, he weakened the balance sheet of Bank of America. And Mr. Clawson, who had great name recognition, but was a much lower profile public figure, did an enormously impressive job of strengthening the finances of this enormous institution. He must have worked like a dog to do so, to get member governments, which is just about all the countries in the world, to either increase their donations or renegotiated loans with recipients that were being repaid at low 1950s and 60s interest rates to reflect the higher interest rates of the 80s. And there were others. Carter also, it's almost never mentioned, but in administrative terms, he had a number of significant impacts. He insisted on a rationalization and clarification of what the organizational responses would be of our government if there were, God forbid, a general nuclear war. And put in place, the military brass, I think, just sort of assumed that they would take over, which is what at some level a lot of them always want to do. But Carter actually put in place a rational nuclear war response policy, something people don't want to think about. Airline deregulation, trucking deregulation, revolutionary changes in the efficiency of transportation. I dare say we wouldn't have Amazon the way Amazon works today without trucking deregulation. Without airline deregulation, air travel has gone from an elite, prosperous person's activity which it was, well into the 60s, to something that everybody, it's like taking the bus nowadays, for better and worse, but that was airline and trucking deregulation.
You know,
And I could go on,
sure,
but I better not.
No, I just want to jump in to say that most of what you laid out as his accomplishments, for one reason or another, I was already aware of. I mean, certainly you talk about the Camp David Accord and his championing of green energy and so on.
Arab-Israel Peace Accord in the Department of Energy. Yeah.
Right. But I do not remember this matter of deregulation. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that in your column and are talking about it now. And in particular, because we tend not to think of deregulation as something that a Democratic president, a liberal president, is going to pursue.
He was a conservative president in many ways. As you often do, you put your finger on it, as I've been busy expatiating here. He focused on a balanced budget, as did Bill Clinton.
Right.
Ironically, it was two Democrats who, in our time, conservative Republicans seem to have forgotten about balancing the budget, starting with Reagan. But you're absolutely right. He was going against, quite courageously, big tides, big trends, and he paid a price.
Right, exactly, of course. I would love to just have you expand on this matter of deregulation again, because it is so forgotten, and now I think you're right, taken for granted. But particularly when it comes to the matter of trucking, what were the regulations, the regulatory system that he either dismantled or reshaped that have changed life as we know it so dramatically?
I don't know the details. I'm confident about what I'm talking about. But the Interstate Commerce Commission had very, very detailed, certainly the safety standards remained in place, but very, very detailed regulations concerning what kinds of trucks can be used, the nature of employment, the Teamsters Union, dealing with a relatively small number of truckers. I'm kind of thinking out loud.
Sure.
The Teamsters Union controlled 90% of the interstate trucking in the U.S. Jimmy Hoffa, who until he was imprisoned, something that had been a vendetta of Attorney General Robert Kennedy, after Kennedy was out of that office, but before he was assassinated, Hoffa went to prison in 1967 and was never able to take over the union again. But he literally was the most powerful person in the country in terms of his ability to shut down the American economy.
Wow.
Jimmy Hoffa could shut us down. With deregulation, far more people could go into the trucking business. And the Teamsters have about 10%, I believe, of interstate truckers signed up as members. I'm very pro-union, by the way. It's interesting to me, at my age, being around younger colleagues who are much more to the left than I am in academia, who are basically hostile to unions. I hear them described as I'm very pro-union, given my work experience from a young age.
Right.
But unions are in decline. And the consumer does, in the long term, benefit in a very rich economy, which we weren't not too many decades ago.
I want to ask you about one other interesting point.
Excuse me, you need protection. The trucking business was a rough, rough business. These men needed unions.
Yeah, understandably.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to think about how the deregulation that occurred under President Carter, how much that has changed the world in which we live and how we get our goods and so on.
Al Kahn, you don't want to read federal regulations necessarily, but Alfred Kahn, another leader, very down-to-earth man from Cornell University, now deceased, I believe, but Professor Kahn, an academic who made a big positive difference, Carter appointed him as kind of czar of deregulation. And he deserves a lot. Read about him, and you can get into the nitty-gritty of deregulation.
Very good. I do want to ask you something else from that same column about President Carter and his legacy. And this, I mean, in the interest of being even-handed, although you're certainly focusing mostly on the accomplishments of Carter that tend to be forgotten, but you certainly acknowledge some of his missteps, you know, certain things that were unfortunate that occurred during his term, including our boycotting of the 1980 Moscow Olympics, which you think was not a good idea. One thing, again, that I did not remember as I look back at Carter's time is you talk about how we, meaning the United States, became rather isolated from some of our most important allies. And I think as you're kind of discussing the same thing, you talk about President Carter's propensity for public judgmentalism, which tended to politically isolate him after a while. And this is probably a really important thing for us to acknowledge, because it's probably one reason why when things went badly, they went as badly as they did.
Yes, he gave top priority to human rights and moral concerns and ethical concerns, including lecturing our allies on the subject, and it created some distance. We were and are very, very closely associated with South Korea, which was a dictatorship under General Park Chung-hee during Carter's presidency. It's now a very successful, very rich economy, very wild but successful democracy, really wild lately. But it is a democracy. That was not the case back then. And Carter would unnecessarily create antagonism by coming across as being holier than thou and lecturing people from very different cultures than our own, including the Congress of the United States, concerning Jimmy Carter's. He would end meetings, I understand, with members of Congress by saying, "I will pray for you. I hope that you," when they disagreed, or even when they agreed. But, you know, dealing with somebody like Tip O'Neill, who you knew, that's secret. An old Boston Paul, and ending by telling him how much I'm going to pray for you too, so you improve.
Mm.
Not the greatest way to try to get along with these characters.
Interesting.
I think of him kind of as the anti-LBJ.
Right. I'm just curious, did you have the opportunity to watch any of President Carter's state funeral?
No, well, but I will.
Okay.
I fully intend to.
I actually
I was not able to do so.
Right. I also was unavailable to actually watch it as it proceeded. I've only seen brief little snippets. It's something I intend to do as well at some point.
But a lot of people did watch it, including a lady at the customer service desk at the local Sunset Foods in my neighborhood in Illinois, and she spontaneously started talking to me about it and raving about how great he was. I did see a lot of him on TV when I was young. I spent a few months in Georgia in the Army at Fort Benning, and isolated in the southwestern corner of Georgia, and at Columbus, mostly going through the infantry officers' school. My branch was intelligence, but in those days, I gather it's changed. You had to go through the infantry school, which I was able to do, but it was an unhappy time for me and for the country and certainly the Army, which was a mess, bluntly, except for elite units. And I became aware of the governor, Carter. This is in the early 1970s. When I was on active duty, and I was really quite drawn to him. There's not a hell of a lot to do in Columbus back then, unless you were really into gambling and drinking, and there was a rich environment for vice. But so I used to watch television, and we did get some time off. And there was this phenomenal governor, whether he was giving a formal speech or speaking more, he was so smart that his impromptu ad hoc remarks would hang together like paragraphs. So I became an enthusiastic supporter of Carter, who was at 1% in the polls in 76, beginning of the year, and was very sorry that he ran into such a buzzsaw in Washington.
Right.
But he was quite there was something quite extraordinary about him. and we do appreciate that now.
Right, absolutely.
But, and I don't want to sound too much like a Yankee, but I that experience confirmed to me that I definitely am a northerner. It was a real desert in Georgia back then, and in the Deep South generally, intellectually. Sam Nunn had not yet been elected. Richard Russell, very segregationist, to be sure, but a very significant long-term leader. He had died. And so I really kind of seized on opportunities to listen to the governor because I was going out of my mind in some ways.
Well, and Governor Carter was, that's an amazing story in and of itself,
it is.
What he did, and, and in particular the way in which he, in a sense, kind of ran as a old-time Southerner, and then once he was inaugurated as governor, immediately reversed what his public position had been, and did all kinds of things for the sake of racial equality in Georgia. I mean,
very telling point.
Yeah,
yeah. No, the when he first ran, I believe he lost in the '60s. He you could see he was really saying what was necessary to get elected.
Right.
But that's certainly not how he operated. A fascinating man. And sorry to be going on at such length, but in happier times in my life, I spent 2 decades at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, working with John Riley and other good people to build up the place. Part of my job was to get to know the right-hand person of VIPs we wanted. So I'd go to and raise money. I went to Washington, New York a lot, but I would go to the Carter Center every couple of years in Atlanta, and watching it evolve from a very modest old Victorian building on the heights around Atlanta to this phenomenal structure, and what they did to abolish guinea worm and river blindness and truly horrible scourges, especially in Africa, is almost unbelievable.
Right. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, inspiring.
Yeah.
It became more and more inspiring, especially when things were hard on the job. I'd really get inspired by just being around the Carter Center.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
If these guys can keep going, I sure as hell can.
Right, right. I want to just add, finally, that I was honored to do a phone interview with former President Carter some years ago, and reran that in a few days after his death. The occasion was we were talking about one of the 34 books that he either wrote or co-wrote during his life.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. A really interesting book about the importance of the separation of church and state.
Huh.
I mean, really interesting given, you know, we've maybe never had a president as devoutly religious as Mr. Carter.
Yes.
And yet someone who even then, but certainly in subsequent years, came to appreciate more and more the importance of the separation of church and state. And so it's a brief interview, less than 10 minutes actually, but remains one of the high points of my many years here at the station. And people can seek that out on the Morning Show archives if you're interested in hearing that. I reshared that at the end of December, and certainly something I will never, ever forget.
I did not. You should do more talking. I should do less.
Not at all. For those of you just joining us, today is the first visit of 2025 from Dr. Art Sear, a monthly visitor to the Morning Show. I do want to be sure to give us a chance to talk about something that very much caught me by surprise, and that was your column about the wildfires in Southern California, these devastating wildfires. I mean, talk about a terrible, tragic catastrophe, and by no means are those difficulties over and done with, as we're hearing now over the last 24 hours. But your column talks about something that is, in a sense, kind of the backdrop against which these fires have taken place, and maybe help explain why, even though these fires were in so many ways unprecedented and very unexpected, that nevertheless the response to them has, in your words, been a bit uncoordinated and disorderly. Those are two of the adjectives you used. And that has something to do with the way in which government tends to function in Southern California, and in particular this thing called decentralization that can sometimes be a real problem when it comes to catastrophes of this scope. I would love to have you kind of give the long view to our listeners of what we're talking about and how and why this sort of state of affairs is in place in Southern California.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I actually was born and grew up there and went to college at UCLA in Los Angeles, and then went east to grad school. The shortage of water is something people have always been conscious of, but particularly in the early years of the community. And I'm young enough to vaguely remember as a child, Governor Pat Brown, Edmund G. Brown, a Democrat elected in 58, re-elected in 1962 by decisively defeating Richard Nixon, and then defeated by Ronald Reagan in 66. He was a very valuable politician. He was not a television-age politician, but he was a great deal maker. And one of his biggest claims to fame was the peace agreement, enormously complicated, that got Northern California water to Southern California and created a reasonably reliable water supply for the first time. A major aqueduct was built around 1930 that brought in water, I believe, from Arizona and parts of Nevada, tapped the Colorado River. But there is no water there. I commend in this media of audiovisual age the film Chinatown, which is a classic American, a truly brilliant cinema that made Jack Nicholson a star. He is, in fact, in every scene of the film. Now, it's a neo-noir film about a private detective in the Great Depression who comes across a scheme to corner the water supply by a ruthless big businessman. It really shows what a brilliant director and writer Roman Polanski was. Notorious person now, unfortunately, after his wife Sharon Tate was murdered, he seemed to become very self-destructive. So he cannot come back to the United States. But he really is a brilliant filmmaker, and the film is phenomenal. It's based on fact, not during the 30s, but around World War I, a group of capitalist robber barons hatched a scheme to capture the water supply of Southern California by draining off what water there was and buying farmland cheap, and they would create a monopoly situation. Fortunately, partly because of the new progressive political movement, they were foiled. I think at least a couple of men went to prison. It showed that times were changing. But they almost did corner the water supply, and local communities became paranoid about water. Pacific Palisades, a prosperous area that burned, literally burned to the ground. Just incredible. Right next door to UCLA, where I went to where I went to college. They are part of the L.A. water system, but the L.A. water system is very limited because Anaheim, Azusa, Burbank, Pasadena go on and on and on. And all these communities that surround a rather small city of Los Angeles government, they've got their own water supply.
So they each have their own water supply.
Yeah. Now, there's effort of coordination, but it's a very... It's a strangely awkward structure. Moreover, these fires and this decentralization was reinforced by the fact that the automobile was early in the 20th century in relatively rich America. Prosperous Americans, the car was becoming our preferred means of transportation, unlike literally the rest of the world. We could afford it, and gas was only about a dime a gallon. During the first couple decades. So the car, water paranoia, created a tremendously decentralized situation. Moreover, in the past, these fires have been concentrated in areas where there was concentrated brush. They're now hitting built-up areas in Los Angeles. So in that sense, it's a new situation, and the structure as I understand it, I'm not an expert on this, but the economic and political structure is not well built to handle this kind of crisis.
Right, especially when something that is of such sprawling scope.
Yeah.
Right, where?
Great Lakes, great contrast with this part of the country, where thanks to the Great Lakes, mainly, we've got plentiful water supply. And our main problem is other parts of the country trying to siphon off water from the Great Lakes. So we have the Great Lakes Compact, which I believe came in about 2008. There are a lot of interesting, very practical problems for policy analysis between the water-rich Midwest and Southern California. But L.A. is, in all kinds of ways, Los Angeles is very different from this our immediate region here.
Right.
Speaking of Wisconsin, Bob La Follette, by the way, was crucial in sparking the progressive movement in California. One of their sons, famous senator and governor and presidential candidate in 1924, one of their sons had a serious lung disease, which was pervasive back then, and they would go out to San Diego, just south of L.A., every winter this time of year, and Fighting Bob couldn't sit still, so he transformed the Republican Party into a progressive beacon. California and Wisconsin were the two really, really powerful progressive states. And that was important in maintaining water in public hands. But it didn't lead to really efficient government organization.
Right.
In the context of California.
Exactly. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah, it really is.
But it's not just climate change and high winds that are causing this total disaster.
Right. There's also,
I hope it's clear.
Yeah, this matter of what the response has been. I mean, it has been a valiant response in terms of those frontline firefighters, but in terms of the large-scale coordination of efforts and so on, that has perhaps not been what it could be, given kind of just sort of the political patchwork that we have in Southern California.
The political consequences are certainly going to be worth following. Gavin Newsom, the fair-haired liberal Democrat from aristocrat from Northern California, who was supposed to be a presidential contender, next time around, I think he's probably dead for sure politically.
You mentioned that he barely survived a recall effort back in, I think, 2021.
Exactly.
And you make mention in your column of how a new effort to recall him is already underway. I mean, you know, there are parts of California still burning, but in other words, he is already now maybe feeling the political consequences of this enormous disaster.
You vote a lot and you vote often in California, and I clearly remember when I became old enough to vote back in the 60s, not only the local government but the League of Women Voters would send you maps with footsteps from your house to the local polling station.
Wow.
And details on where you register. And they have all kinds of initiative and referenda. So practice for being a lawyer, you'd get these briefs for both sides before the... I decided to change my residency to Massachusetts when I went to grad school. And in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I tried to... I could not literally find out how to register. I talked to these strange guys on the telephone, and it turned out it was the VFW hall two doors from my modest apartment on Bryant Street in Cambridge by Massachusetts. But the local organization, they don't want you to, you know, if they don't know you, they don't really want you that much. And that was still in effect back then.
Interesting. Wow. Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I think one of the things we will need to do is you have a very interesting column about the Arctic region. I think we will save that for your next visit in February.
Okay.
I want to give you just a chance, and again, we just have literally just a couple of minutes, but one of your columns most recently is a tradition of yours towards the beginning of each calendar year, where you try to spell out some positive, encouraging news. And you do this for a very specific reason, because you very rightly say that so much of mainstream media is constructed, geared for what becomes media hysteria and a real focus on catastrophes and so on. And one of the consequences of that is that it obscures certain fundamental progress in the human race that needs to be acknowledged.
Yeah, I believe that situation has gotten worse with the decline, especially of traditional newspapers, but also radio and even television. These employees are not reporting the news. They're trying to generate ratings and subscriptions and fearful for their own survival, and they're answerable to accounting and finance MBAs nowadays. But beyond that, news disasters always sell newspapers, and it's important to keep in mind that the human lifespan in industrial nations has doubled from about 40 years to about 80 years during the 20th century. Mind you, a big factor there is the fact that a lot of women used to die in childbirth into the 20th century, and that is not the case anymore. But more general advances in public health and government regulation of food and beverages, and a better environment in terms of atmospheric pollution, all kinds of things. We're living longer. Absolute destitution, as defined by the World Bank, is now down to about 10% of the world's population. 30 or 40 years ago, it was more like 30 or 40%.
And you rightly point out that through much of human history, the vast majority of people lived in what we would now call poverty, and many of them in severe poverty.
Yes.
And we should not take for granted the kind of progress that has elevated so many people into a better standard of living.
Yeah, democracy is growing. We were on the defensive during much of the Cold War, but democracy is growing. The only real dictatorship left in Latin America, they used to be pervasive, but it's the geriatric communists in Cuba, even the autocrats in Venezuela, successors to Hugo Chavez. They do have to have elections and face the people, and their days are numbered. It's just a phenomenal positive series of developments in the 20th century.
We should not forget that. Well, we will look forward to having you back with us in February and March and April and all the months thereafter to get more insights from you on a wide variety of issues and concerns. It's always great to have you here, Dr. Art Sear. Thank you so much for being my guest today on The Morning Show.
Well, you're very kind and generous, and I always learn a lot. Thank you so much.
Dr. Art Sear, our guest on The Morning Show today here on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be talking with the Poets Laureate in both Kenosha and Racine, and talking about the place that poetry can have in our collective lives together. Next week, we have some interesting guests, including the superintendent of the Kenosha Unified School District, talking about the upcoming referendum for Kenosha Unified. Both Tuesday and Wednesday, we are devoting to the wonderful Wisconsin writer Michael Perry. We will be sharing an archival interview and then a newly recorded interview as well. We're talking with him because we have he is going to be appearing at the Racine Theater Guild on the 1st of February. And then we'll be talking with a representative of Wisconsin Energy, as well as a concerned environmentalist, about a new proposed gas plant in southern Wisconsin. We'll talk about what is proposed and some of the concerns that it has raised. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org, or you can subscribe to the podcast version to hear a different morning show 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Our weather forecast calls for mostly sunny skies, and we're headed for a high of 19 degrees. It will be very cold tonight. We drop down to plus one for our overnight low. Tomorrow, though, under sunny skies, we warm back up to 20 degrees, and by Saturday, we should be seeing highs in the mid-30s. And we should be up in the 30s for our daytime highs for the foreseeable future through at least the middle of next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elk.